Welcome to Bon Jovi Discussions. Today I have an absolute legend in the rock and roll world, someone who works incredibly hard behind the scenes to bring us some of the greatest rock bands in the world. He's managed Motley Crue, Kiss, Hootie and the Blowfish, our favorite band, Bon Jovi, and so many more. So it's truly an honor to have Doc McGee on the show today. How are you?
Very good here. How are you?
Good. I sincerely appreciate you taking the time to come on today, because I see you all I listen to your podcast all the time in the the Kiss world. You go on the Kiss podcast with different fans and update them on Kiss, and I was like, we gotta have them come on to talk about Bon Jovi and all that fun stuff. So it's great to have you on.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be on, actually.
Yeah. And sorry, I got tickle in my throat here. It's funny too because you're a famous rock manager, and you see any other rock manager out there and they're not really well known or famous, and they do so much behind the scenes and they don't get the proper recognition that they deserve, but then you have all this recognition out there, and I think that's awesome.
No, it's listen, it's just if you're there and you do good things, people know what you do. That's all. It's not like, I'm not a self-promoter. I don't try to be bigger than the bands. I never have.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it's very hard for you to find pictures of me with the bands or with people because I never did that. I'm not the guy in the front. I'm not looking to be the idol maker or something. This is my passion and this is what I do. There's a time and place for everything. The reason why I'm here is because I can keep those guys out front. So that's the key, and one of the keys.
And you mentioned, you don't have many photos out there with the band, and that's the truth. With Bon Jovi, there's like barely any photos of you with them. And if there is, it's like there's one that's like you're on the plane, and it's not really meant to be a photo, but someone captured it. And then there's one of you in
Yeah.
John Ward show. And so, but before we get into the whole Bon Jovi stuff, I'm obviously you've been a manager of Kiss, what, since '96, correct?
Yeah, 95, yeah. Same thing.
95. And Kiss is in my top five favorite bands. And so I wanted to ask you, how was it like to necessarily conclude? Because I know you're still doing stuff with Kiss and so forth, but the touring aspect, how was that? How was the last leg of that tour, end of the road?
Well, it's funny because when you take an artist and you're able to bring them back to life. Okay. It's like breaking a new artist. Okay. So Kiss in 95, we had to, and it's not because anything was just culturally, the Kurt Cobain invasion of, the alternative scene that came on. And the grunge world, really, really devastated the kind of the classic rock or the production rock. Okay. And it took everyone that was in that more of that production, including Bon Jovi and Def Leppard and Scorpions and AC/DC and everybody else. It took them all a little step backwards. During that time, because it was a whole different way kids were starting to look at things from basically grunge. And so then in 1995, I felt that, when Gene and Paul decided that they were going to put makeup back on, I went, if you're going to do that, let's do it the right way. And we launched it and we did Tiger Stadium as the first show. And we did, I rented the Intrepid and did four songs on the Intrepid for some Kiss fans to have a first time in 17 years here back in makeup. Conan O'Brien was our host, and we announced one show, Tiger Stadium. We sold it out in 20 minutes, and the rest is history. And this last tour, we did 287 shows in 59 countries. We played Brazil like 26 times. It was crazy. And it was an amazing way to finish up the first 50 years of Kiss. So We did it at the Garden. We did a great takeover in New York, and set them up for our new ventures with Pop House and building our new future of our Avatar shows and our movies and all that kind of stuff. So so this next 50 years of KISS, I don't know how long I'll be around for it, but I'll be able to see a lot of it. It's like taking the kid again and bringing him up. So that's what I like to do. I love blowing things up. I love making things bigger than life.
And that's what KISS is.
Well, that's what all of us. That's what Bon Jovi was. That's what Motley was. That was Scorpions, Skids. I go on and on and on and on. Guns N' Roses to everything else. So, and that's what I do.
So you're enjoying, you know, I think you call it QTR, which is quality time remaining.
Yes. Now QTR is quality time remaining, but it doesn't mean that you're out of the music business or you're out of business and you're going to go play golf and walk in the sand and shit. Okay. It's just that I'm not going to be 6-7 months on the road.
Yeah.
You know, every year away from home. And I love it. And I love doing shows and I love going to shows, but this is just a new chapter. And the biggest thing for us was to be able to spend more time with the people that we neglected to get where we're at today.
Yeah.
So your family and friends and things that we didn't get a chance to see. And a lot of them have passed away over the years and that we'll never get to see. So it's just another section of your life that's just a little bit more intimate than the craziness of what we've done for 50 years.
Yeah. Well, it was, I watched, I pay-per-view, was it pay-per-view? The last show that you guys live streamed? Yeah. Cause I was going to I had my bags packed for Toronto and I know Paul got sick and stuff. And so I was kind of expecting to get canceled and respectively. So, you know, we're all human. And, I did get to watch the pay-per-view of the last night and it was just magical. And it was great for, you know, for people that weren't there to still in a way be included. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought it really came out off well. And the new shows, the documentaries that's coming, the live show, our VR, our VR shoots that we're doing that's becoming, some very interesting stuff for people to see, and biopics and stuff. So there's so much stuff coming. It's crazy. It's great. Yeah.
No, I'm looking forward to it. You know, like I said, KISS is in my top five favorites. So I always like to kind of see what they're up to and what's coming and stuff. And KISS will always live on, you know, past all of our lives. And so, well, let's get started. So let's go way back. How did you get started in, you know, the rock world and, you know, becoming a manager and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, it would take us more than 45 minutes to get through this in 50 years, but you know, listen, I was a musician, I was a guitar player, all that stuff, but it had nothing to do with how I got into the business. Okay. I got out of the army. I went to Florida. I was waiting tables. I sold cars. I sold construction equipment. I was just trying to find my way around the world. And I met this guy, Bob Sterling, through my sister, Patty, and who was doing, he had a company called A. Sterling Gold. He was doing Goodbye Norma Jean, The Story of Marilyn Monroe, a movie, and another movie called Winter Kills. And he wanted me to work on his artists that were writers and actually work on demoing their stuff and getting them to different people to cover them and stuff like that. That's how it actually started. And so I went down back to Miami, and then I just met all kinds of people. And as I met everybody down in Miami, Miami had its own little thing in the 70s, okay? It was like Laurel Canyon in the West Coast, New York, and Miami had this Miami Sound Machine, the Bee Gees, Eric Clapton, everybody was down there in that world, okay? And so it was a real healthy music scene in Miami at that time. So, and it just snowballed. And I had a guy that was the engineer that did a lot of my recordings, became producer and produced, you know, the Styx records and the Ohio Players and Robin Trower. We found Benny Mardonis and did Into the Night and all that kind of stuff and that whole thing. And it just kept moving. And then I went up to New York and quickly and ended up signing James Brown and Isaac Hayes and Melanie. And we signed, well, I had this band called Night Flight that had Phyllis Hyman in it, Howard Johnson, who was on A&M, R&B singer. He was 16 years old. He was a Cuban guy, Sandy Toronto, Steve Ferrone of the Average White Band, Henry Stewart of the Average White Band, Lamont Johnson, the bass player, the Brecker Brothers, David Sanborn, all these great, but nobody knew who they were back then. They were just the new up-and-coming kids, okay? And then, you know, and then in the late 70s, I was hanging out with Pat Travers in Miami and Coconut Grove, and I ended up managing him, and that really got me into the rock world in the sense of I was hanging out with everybody in the rock side with Pat, who was an amazing band back then. And then, of course, in 82, I flew out and signed Motley Crue at New Year's Evil. And then Bon Jovi, I flew, you know, from New York, we came in and I saw Johnny and we got together and started that historic march on the world. And Hootie and the Blowfish was there and just all kinds of people. It was like Toto and, you know, we had Night Ranger and, you know, Toto and some of the people that didn't make it, like Vintage Trouble. Amazing band. Love that band. And when they would play, somehow it didn't connect. But there was some really, really awesome Mallory Hope, who's an amazing, I love this girl, and she sings. Even Gene Simmons said to me, if you don't break this girl, you should get out of the business because she's so good. And she was. She's just she's one of those crazy things. Bonnie McKee, who wrote all the stuff for from Britney Spears to Katy Perry and all those hits and all that stuff. And, you know, I signed her when she was 17, but she didn't connect as an artist. But she's an amazing writer and singer and great person. So there's just so many different facets of the music business that I've been able to be part of. It just keeps coming. So it's awesome.
You know this more than I do, obviously, but you know, the music industry is just such a tough thing to crack. I mean, I have friends who are trying to make it and stuff. And it's just, it's tough. You know, and I think the great thing today is, you know, like back then, you know, you found bands at bars and stuff or who you knew. But nowadays, you know, people have the internet to kind of break themselves, if you will. And so it's definitely a different dynamic. What do you think of that dynamic now versus then?
Well, you know, everything's different. Okay, of course. And it changes. It goes through cycles every 2-3 years. Okay. It just gets a little quicker nowadays. Okay. There's just, when you have so much information, you forget about a lot of the things that you need to do. The things that are common sense things, like working hard, like getting your shit together and getting and building your fan base and building this stuff. And, you know, if you come here and you have plan B, like you go, well, after this doesn't work, I'll do this. And this doesn't work, I'll do that. Don't come to me. I don't have plan B.
Yeah.
Okay. But I'm a plan A guy. Okay. And that's, if you can't be the biggest band in the world, don't come to me.
Yeah. And I think that shows how committed and dedicated you are if you only have a plan A and no backup plans whatsoever. You know, I think you have more of a drive to succeed.
It's hard enough, okay? But nothing's hard. I haven't had a bad day since my mother dropped me off at kindergarten, okay? So I live a very charmed life. But you know, when people say, "How are you going to do that?" I go, "I don't know. Figure it out. We'll go do it." Okay, and that's what we do. You know, I mean, it's not something that you can plan and say, "Oh, well, if he does this, it'll go to here, and then it'll go here, and then it'll..." That shit doesn't work. Okay, there's no substitute for hard work. Okay, and the people that do it win, and people that don't. That's all. It's pretty simple. So the internet and everything, listen, it's the same thing as it was 50 years ago. Everything is word of mouth. Just today we have a bigger mouth.
Bigger mouth. Okay. I like that.
We have the internet. That's it. And you got to be really careful because the internet can help you and the internet can kill you. Okay. And before it was, don't say this or stay out of the press or stay out of this and won't be doing this. And nowadays, everybody thinks, well, I got to show my dog and where I last went to the bathroom and here, look what I have for breakfast. And the fuck's that? I see some of these things and I go, that's retarded. But that's okay because that's not going to happen. And that leaves room for the people that know what they're doing and go forward. The Taylor Swifts of the world that weren't great singers, that weren't, that got dropped. She didn't have a plan B. Okay. She was going to be a fucking star, period. Okay. And I've known her for that many years. And that's what she is. And that's what everybody that is in that is a plan A guy.
And I guess that kind of leads us into starting, discovering Bon Jovi in it, because obviously you know how driven John and the band was. So I know you mentioned a couple minutes ago that you discovered John and the band in New York City back in 80, was it 83 or 84?
Was 83.
83. So was this before John formed Bon Jovi, or was it when he just had Runaway and was looking for a band?
John had Runaway. He had Dave, was his keyboard player. Richie and everybody else never played on Runaway. And didn't play on the first record because John was working at the, well, you know all this stuff. He was working at
Power
the
station,
power
yes.
station. And actually, the name of his band was the Power Station. Okay. That's what he wanted to call his band. And he was leaning more towards Southside Johnny. You know, that's the kind of thing that he was doing, which was great. Yeah, and that whole Jersey scene was great with the horns and all that stuff. But that wasn't where I was at. Or where I wanted to go, or where I knew he could go. And so we just, between Johnny and I and Richie and Tico and Dave and Al, who was the coolest guy ever. Whether anybody likes to hear this or not, Alex John Such was fucking cool. That he was the shit. He really was. He was the guy. And he brought in Richie and Tico, okay, and brought him in the band. And this is probably all in the documentary, but you know, over the years, I mean, one of the titles of my book, which I'm not putting out, but anyways, the title of my book is A Mind's a Fucked Up Thing, okay? And the reason for that is because everybody believes their own shit, including me, okay? So, yeah, so when I tell a story, there's probably five different versions of that story from other people. Now, I believe mine is the answer, and they all believe theirs is. So, hey, you know, it's whatever. So, at any rate, but what isn't questionable is how all these people got to where they're at. Okay, and that's connection, and that's work. And they all did it, and that's why they were where they're at.
So then you saw, Snake Sabo and the band obviously before Richie came in. Did
Sure.
you think that they would have succeeded as well with Snake, or was there kind of a different magic when Richie came in?
I think that there was a different level because Snake is great and love him. He's my brother. Okay.
Absolutely.
It was a different dynamic. Okay. And I think Snake needed to be by himself with Rachel to write some of these great songs that he wrote. That wouldn't have been Bon Jovi-ish. Okay. Or wouldn't have, you know, Snake didn't, I don't think Snake fit in that where Johnny was going at the time. Okay. And then Richie and them were already there. And Richie's so talented. I mean, probably had more fun with Bon Jovi and the guys through that formative years of 5, 10 years of building, you know, until at least the 6 years. I love the concept of, I have a one chapter in the book called Before the Zeros When It Was Fun.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's what I love. Okay. Once you get big and now all of a sudden, instead of sweeping floors, instead of being humble, you know everything. You're a fucking genius now because you had two hit songs. So that's that. And so to me, that the monumental moments is when you're sitting in Sioux Falls, South Dakota at a hotel and you're playing with, I think we're playing with, I'll think of it in a second. Anyways, and we have the number one record in America. It was Slippery, yeah. And those type of moments that you know the tipping points that it's moving. You know what I mean? And listen, Johnny had a lot of problems all the way up through for 4 years. We did two records that didn't connect well. But they were stepping stones for Johnny. And he had, and not just Johnny, the whole band. That was a family. That was a family. That band was a best friends. And not unlike a lot of bands that when they get together, they're best friends for a while, and which happens and it goes. But anyways, and they fought through it and they learned to be a rock band. They learned to find their place, their path.
Yeah.
Okay. And they owned it.
And they blew it up. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think that's, you know, like fans like me, especially in the diehard fandom, we really appreciate the debut album and 7800 album because it's a lot different than any album from Slippery and on. You know, and like you kind of said, it was a stepping stone, and I think it was the band trying to find their path, find their sound, what works, what doesn't work. And they're both phenomenal albums, especially 7800.
Yeah, you know, there's everybody, again, you know, if you're talking about Kiss, people say, I love the album. And I go, so you were the guy that bought it. Okay. but at the time, I mean, there were some massive records flying around. I mean, the Def Leppards, everything that was coming out was massive. You know what I mean? And selling records out the ass. You know what I mean? Motley was blowing through the moon. I mean, Metallica was blowing. Everybody was going in that rock world was huge. Okay, so it just started going. So when we finished with 7800 and getting ready to do Slippery, kind of just changed the whole motive and made it fun because it wasn't fun. That 7800 degrees time frame wasn't fun for anybody. It was kind of like coming off of your first record, which you're listening to your songs on the radio for the first time in your life before the zeros when it was fun, and you're traveling all over the world, okay? And you're partying and you're having meeting people from, you're standing in Russia, and you're standing in every place, you know, Yugoslavia, and you play, you know, and you're not a star, you're not big there, but you set your seeds. And so you plant your seeds as you go every year. And after 4 years, these guys in Bon Jovi and all my bands internationally were set. So when they had Slippery, we blew up in Japan because we've been there 3 times, okay? Without having hits, okay? We had been to Germany 6, 7 times, played shows everywhere, okay? And so they had that foothold, and all they needed to have was the record, the right record. Well, not just the right songs, because the songs are better when you're in that limelight, okay? When all of a sudden, you know, we had a tipping point back then, okay? And the tipping point for us was MTV. So we had something that nobody had. We had Wayne Isham that sat there and did the $1 Million Smile with John. He did, you know, he did Madonna and everybody else, but he knew John, and he knew Richie, and he knew, and if you notice, all my videos that were all my big videos are just performance videos. Okay. I never liked or never wanted anybody to do where the guy's a bartender and the other guy's driving the cab and then they come around the corner. And what the fuck is that? They're a rock band. All I wanted was an infomercial to my show. And when you see Living on a Prayer, that's the infomercial for the show.
Yeah. And I think songs like, you know, music videos for like Prayer and Bad Name or Wild in the Streets, all from, you know, Slippery. Those videos really showed you how the bond that the band had with each other, with the fans. And you know, I think that's what made people want to go see them, you know, kind of give you a glimpse.
That's it. They didn't go see it because the guy was playing like he was selling hot dogs on the corner. And then the bass player pulled out of the cab and got out with a silly hat on and did some Beatle thing. That was terrible shit.
And, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, they were more, you know, Bon Jovi was more successful live more than, you know, the debut in 7800, because I think the saying goes, they were the best kept secret in rock and roll. And, you know, all these great bands that they got to open for jokingly would say that they would steal the show.
Yeah, a lot of it, yes. A lot of it, no. But a lot of it was, the band finding themselves, okay, and melding together. It's very difficult to explain because you just have to be there. But when you're there, and you know, Johnny quit school because there was recess. Okay, he's the fucking hardest working guy. He works his ass off, and from the time he started. From the time we got together, he sat and watched everybody. David Lee Roth, watched Klaus Meine, watched everybody, okay? And made his and built his persona. He didn't have the one-trick pony and he did one move and that was it. They were an aggressive rock band that went out and kicked ass. And that's what everybody wanted to see, with great, great playing, great singing, aggressive. They went after everybody. You know, we pulled off so many great tricks from in Australia and Japan, all over the world. So all these things are, you know, that one thing doesn't break you, okay? And one thing doesn't kill you, okay? It's like cancer comes a little bit at a time and success comes a little bit at a time. So these are all pieces of the puzzle. That what I do is orchestrate the pieces of the puzzle.
So essentially, you know, they were learning their craft and
absolutely
and was right. And that's, so they're on Backstage with Bon Jovi. I don't know if you've checked out that website yet, but they just started to do it where they put on, you know, archives of different things throughout their 40 years of career. There's a special thing I wanted to ask about. So when Bon Jovi opened up for Kiss in 84, the very last show, they did these balloons when Kiss was playing these. I'll let you tell the story. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Well, no, but no, go ahead. You can tell me, because I don't want to get into it. But yeah,
Okay.
no, this everybody does that. But go ahead, you tell the story.
Okay. So correct me if I'm wrong here. So I guess, so it was the last show that Bon Jovi opened up for Kiss. And they had the crew right before Kiss started their show put all these balloons up in up on top, and while Kiss was performing, all these balloons as a prank just came down and filled the stage, balloons everywhere.
Yeah, well, when you tour so long with each other, and we did, we had, I don't know how many shows. I think there was, and I could be wrong, but I think there was something like 60 shows in Europe or maybe more. I think we played 14 or 15 shows in England.
Wow.
And we played a roller skating rink in Oostel, okay, fucking out of nowhere. We played, we every town we stopped and played. It was crazy. We played, I've never played that many different cities in England with any band. And we did the same thing in Japan. We did it everywhere through Germany. So I wanted these guys to play everywhere and get a taste for, well, to understand that this, and that was the best time in your life. Because you're going from zero, to a million, and you're moving fast, and it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So when you were managing Bon Jovi from, 83 up until 86, when they were just starting to become something and, weren't blowing up the world yet. And then obviously Slippery in New Jersey were just this massive, I mean, they were literally the biggest band. How harder did your job become after Slippery with managing?
It becomes different because now you're in a different mode. Okay. Now you're in not just maintaining, but you're into how do you better this, do something better than this, do something better than that. And so then we ended up with, which I thought was a great move, was doing Blaze of Glory. Okay. And with Jim Robinson and Morgan Creek Films. And doing that whole thing. Okay. And that was another side of it. Then Richie did Stranger in This Town. And so it was showing different styles and different things to make people want to see more of everyone. Okay. And so that is a more difficult, less fun. Okay, because of egos, and that's just how it goes, including mine. Okay, so it's a very, if you said, how does Brady and Parcells get along? Well, I'm sure that through seven Super Bowls, they were, rubbing dickheads by the fire, singing Kumbaya, and then all of a sudden it got to be where they didn't get along because they had different visions. Of what went on. And that's what happens in any relationship, most relationships. Some can go on for, whatever. When you have strong personalities and you have strong convictions on what you want to do, maybe they want to go in a direction that I don't believe in. Okay. And I don't believe that's good for them, so I'm not going to say it is. Okay, and if that pisses them off, then that pisses them off. I'm sorry, I'm not here. It's not a popularity contest. I'm in the music business. So, that's really it. So a lot of it is, yeah, maybe did I piss everybody off? Probably. Okay. But that's my job. Before it wasn't pissing them off, it was giving them an opportunity. Okay, and so as they get bigger and bigger, most people turn it around and they want to do things that I would think wouldn't be the way to do it.
They want to branch off and try something new.
Well, try something new is okay because you need to try something new. You need to do a Young Guns. You need to do a Stranger in This Town. You need to do Springsteen needed to do Nebraska. You know, coming off the such a huge record of Born in the USA. How do you follow up Born in the USA? He comes out with Nebraska. Okay, and very people go, oh fuck, that's horrible. It wasn't horrible. It was a different side of what he wanted to show, you know what I mean? It was a different side of that, and that's what I think Young Guns was.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? That and all that stuff. So it just became a different animal. Okay, and like I said, sometimes you survive it, and sometimes you don't.
So what was your whole stance then? You know, obviously at the end of the New Jersey tour, they were just worn out and tired and just couldn't do it anymore. How soon were you wanting the band to come back to do more, or were you on board with the whole Blaze of Glory?
Well, okay. I'm not sure, and I know this is a Bon Jovi podcast, okay, but I wouldn't think that this is worn out time where everybody's worn out.
Okay.
After Jersey, after New Jersey show, and we did a lot of shows, there was just starting that inner fighting. There was just starting that, this is bullshit. This, you know what I mean? And so you start, and yes, maybe in hindsight, if you stopped it 6 months before, would that have changed what Richie and Johnny did later on? Probably, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. You know what I mean? What happened in that whole thing? But it's about being out there and doing your thing. You know what I mean? It's not like you're working on a railroad. You're not driving spikes. You're flying in a fucking G5. You stay in the best hotels and you play four nights a week. You work 8 hours a week.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's that the guys that do my lawn here fucking work. they climb trees and cut the shit every day for 10 hours. So I don't have a lot of like, now the fact of being away from home, missing your family, I get it, because if you noticed, I was there.
Yep.
Okay. It wasn't like I wasn't there. Like I was sitting at my house playing golf, seeing my family and doing everything else. I was on the road with my bands and always have been for 50 years.
And correct me if I'm wrong here. Wasn't it your idea that you came up with the whole Access, which I loved, the Access All Areas documentary that they did?
Yeah. You know, but, you know, it's not just who comes up with anything, right? It's we're all come up with shit, okay? Al would come up with something. Tico would come up with something. We're all pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Some may be better ideas than others. You know what I mean? Some ideas work and some ideas don't. And so some of the things that I get credit for were monumental pieces, because that's really what I have to do. My job is to change your lives. It's not to make sure that they get their car cleaned or that they get, you know, the dog is, can you take care of my dog? And hey, doc, go get me a, Starbucks. Okay. That's what I do. I change your lives.
Yeah.
I blow their lives up. And when you don't blow their lives up, you're not around. That's it.
Yeah.
That's how it works. And a lot of times people resent that.
Right.
Okay. And they know better and they're going to go do it, which is fine. It's, you know, that's what life's about. That's what people do.
Yeah.
And so with that, there's no matter what could be said or I could say, the only thing I have is great fucking memories of all the shit, whether it's good, bad, the ugly. Okay. It's all part of what my life is.
What's your absolute favorite memory with the band? I know there's probably a million, but what's the first one that comes to mind?
Yeah, I think it, when we were doing Castle Donington, when we opened, when I put them up at Castle Donington, and they were throwing shit at them. And I used to call it Routine 13. And I'd yell Routine 13, which means they would run around the stage so they couldn't hit them. So Johnny and Richie, you know, they take off running, they just go, they run all over the place. Fucking a pig's head got thrown up on stage.
Oh my God.
They threw piss at them. They did, but that was the culture of Donington at that time. Okay, the opening band got pummeled.
No matter who you were.
Oh yeah, Motley Crue, we had three darts in the drum kit. When we took it out, somebody threw fucking darts from the crowd.
Now you can't get that stuff through security at
Yeah,
Venmo.
there was a cow's eyeball stuck on Tommy's drum. So, but I think that was really great. I mean, that was a great time. I mean, and we kicked ass. Bon Jovi was as on fire as you could get somebody. You know, they were they, you know, he climbed the rafters, he'd do it, you know, whatever it took to win the night, that's where he was going.
Another thing too, I know that a lot of fans have always wondered, and maybe you can bring some clarity to this. For the New Jersey tour, they live shows were recorded in plans of maybe a live album down the road, like Guns N' Roses did. Why
Yeah.
never came to, completion? Why come we never got that? Was there a reason?
It was just kind of when are you gonna do it? I mean, the music was so good that they were coming up with. There was no reason to do a live record at the time. You know, we had live singles, we put some different things out, picture discs, all this kind of stuff. We did more shit in Japan and Europe before they could blew up. David Munns, who worked with and another guy named David Thorner out of England, who spent so much money on Bon Jovi in the early days, because he liked the band, and we would talk every day. And I had a telex machine that I there's no, there was no internet, there was no fax machine. Okay, there was a telex machine. And you would type it and put a ribbon on it and send it to them. And that's how you did it. Or you'd call. And the calls were so expensive. I mean, this is in the late 70s and 80s. We were sitting there, my phone bill was something like $10,000 or $12,000 a month
Wow.
back then.
That's insane.
Because I'd be on with all the promoters, all the marketing people, all the local affiliates of the record labels, and you had to be on top of these people all the time.
Do you think that live that because I mean Bon Jovi was literally the biggest band at the time. Do you think if a New Jersey live album New Jersey tour live album was released. Do you think it would have been a big thing? A lot of people would have bought it, and kind of like how
You
Evolution kind of blew up.
know, I think they would have, but they didn't need it.
That's
You know what I
true. That's true.
mean? They didn't, you know, when you do, okay, Kiss came out with Kiss Alive. And they came out with Kiss Alive because they just had two records that flopped. Okay. And so Bill Lacoin said, "You're such a great live band, okay, that we're going to do a live record." Now, it was against what everybody knew to do, but Bill Lacoin didn't know any better. That's why it was successful. See, everybody in this business thinks they know fucking so much, okay? And if you really want to know the truth, if you think you know what you're doing, duck, because you get your ass handed to you. You know, You go after things. You go. You fight for everything. And you go for it, and that's it. You don't think you know this, and you're going to strategically put this here, and I'm going to put it. It doesn't work like that.
Right.
You catch a wave. You look for the wave. You're out there on a fucking paddleboard.
Yeah.
And you're looking for the right wave to run. That's what I do.
Yeah. I guess you are right. You know, as much as we would love that live album, you're right. The band really didn't need to put it out for any reason. You know, they were already on top of the world.
Well, they needed it to have it for archival, to do things. If you wanted to put something out, if you wanted your documentaries or something, those type of things, that's what those were made for MTV.
Okay. Well, another big thing I wanted to ask, and I know you get asked this all the time, but it's a big part of your career, Moscow. And I just think this story is so unique. So if you don't mind sharing, you know, Moscow, the story, and, you know, I think
that would take hours, but there is a documentary coming on Moscow, and Johnny did it already. And so this should come out sometime this year. We don't know. I really think it's cool. It's done by Words and Pictures and a network out of people who did The Last Dance, Michael Jordan, and also a network that's done everything. And so anyways, Moscow was one of those things that I wanted to do. And so I did it.
Yeah.
And whether people liked it, loved it, hated it, whatever, thought it was a get out of jail free card for me, or whatever they want to think of is what they want to think. It was history.
Right. What I think is so cool about it was just bringing all these great bands together in a place where music was essentially banned. I mean, I've heard you talk about another podcast, but the fact that you'd get arrested if you owned a record or you listened to music, it was just mind blowing. And to kind of have these bands in a peaceful manner come in and play, that's just, it's phenomenal.
I thought it was something that I wanted to do. Had no idea how to do it. Nobody had ever done it. Certainly not to our scale. We did 140,000 people a day. For 2 days, we did 280,000 people in Lennon Stadium with no permits, with no nothing. And we put it on Russian television for the first time in the history of the Soviet Union to be on, first time a rock band's ever been on television, ever in the history of the Soviet Union. On their television set, we released, New Jersey was the first Western record to be released in the Soviet Union.
Was it? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it was the first record to ever be released in the Soviet Union.
Geez, I never knew that. That's awesome. Yeah.
So there's a lot of different layers of Moscow.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons why I went a certain way in order to get to not be arrested when I landed in Moscow.
Yeah.
Which I thought we were going to.
You and the bands and everyone?
Yes, I was on the plane.
Didn't you have to bring like a whole crew with you to kind of set up, clean up?
I brought up 641 people to Moscow, 64 tractor trailers from all over the world.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. So, it was my biggest accomplishment, I think, by far.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm very proud of it. And however we got there and did it, I'm proud of all the guys, Motley and Bon Jovi and Ozzy, and everybody was Skid Row and all the Motley guys, everything else. You know, nobody knew it, even including me, what it was going to do to the world, how it was going to affect a Soviet society.
Yeah.
Okay. Gorbachev knew. Okay. Gorbachev thought he knew. He didn't. He told me later in 91 that the reason why it happened is because he didn't say no.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, and then in 91, his grandkids' favorite song was Wind of Change, which was written about Moscow from Klaus, the Scorpions.
Wind of Change is written about Moscow?
Yeah.
Jeez, I didn't know that.
Huh. Yeah. Actually, Klaus started whistling, doing that whistling in Moscow.
Okay. Wow. So, I never knew that.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. I just have a couple more things to ask you, and I know you've given a lot of your time here. The upcoming Bon Jovi documentary. I know you don't want to give too much away with it being out next week, but what can you say about your part in the documentary?
You know something? I guess I'm part of the first part of, and I'm very proud to be part of that. Yeah. And I'm extremely proud of Johnny and the band, and actually Dorothea and every the family, and Mr. and Mrs. B and Matt, and Tony, and you know, it's kind of like our surrogate family. We were together for so many years, and so it was an honor to actually be part of it.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to your part.
Yeah, for me, I don't even know what they cut out or they didn't.
Yeah, I think your interview, what, a couple years ago, right when they were starting to do it, I think you were.
No, I did. Oh, I did. Here, it had to be a year ago.
A year ago? Okay.
Yeah.
And I think it's great that they include you because, like I said, you are such a monumental part in their career, and you were with them when they blew up, and you've pretty much got them to, you know, with other help and hands too, but, you know, you got them to be so successful. So I think it's really great that they have you in the documentary and that you guys have been friends all these years since, which kind of makes me want to ask about your dismissal from your exit from the band in 92. You know, how did that come about or whatever you want to share?
You know, something it's, I mean, shit happens.
Yeah.
Okay. Johnny and I disagreed. Yeah. Okay. And that's pretty much it. I didn't like the direction he was going in. He didn't like the direction I was going in.
Right.
Pretty simple.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that at all.
So that happens. Okay. And, you know, I'm happy that he was able to continue his path, because once you have that path and you know where you're going and you ran down that road, you can go down that road.
Yeah,
you know, and he's done a fabulous job, yeah. And it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. And I hope Richie gets back in the band with Johnny.
Yeah,
I truly hope that they heal that for all the fans,
yeah.
that would love to, and me one of them,
right.
to sit and watch those two sit and go back and forth and sing with each other. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. You know, I know you could say it for Kiss because, you know, right when Kiss was reunited with Ace and Peter and stuff, you know, there's just that magic from the beginning. And, you know, a lot of fans, I've talked to a lot of fans that have never seen John and Richie play together. And there's magic there. And even if it's for one show, you know, I just think it'd be great to see them together one more time at least, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, you never say never to anything. And I'm sure they've talked, and I know they have, and they should, because both of them, they're like my kids, okay? And I'd love to see them go. I'd love to stand there and watch it.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Rock Hall was so special too, because that's the last time that we will ever see those five together. And I remember when the, I'm sorry.
I didn't say anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, the Rock Hall is so special because you got to see all five of them together celebrating their legacy, and and unfortunately that was the last time that we'll ever see them all five together. But yeah, so but anyway, one last thing before we end the podcast here. There's a quote that I absolutely love that you say, and it's if it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing.
That's it. It's what I live by, bud.
Yeah, I absolutely respect that motto, and so. But before I end the recording here, just stay on for a second. I sincerely appreciate you taking the time to come on and let me talk your ear off about Bon Jovi and hearing your stories. And I just sincerely appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and I'm happy that you're at the helm of the Bon Jovi podcast because I see the passion that you have for it.
Yeah.
And you're young enough to hardly remember some of this stuff.
I
And
know.
so it's nice to see somebody that's not just into the newer thing and understands and feels of what this is. And certainly was an amazing ride for me.
Yeah. And I thank you for all the work that you put into them and to make them successful and who they were and who they are now. And, it's much appreciated. By not just me, but by so many fans out there. So, and again, thank you so much.
You got it. And all the best to all the Bon Jovi fans out there.
All right, let me end this recording real quick so it saves and